Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, June 8th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Monday. You see your sarcasm in my voice. Mondays are always tough for me. It was a very long weekend. It was a very long week last week, but we're back. It's Monday, and we got 4.5 more days to go until we get back to Friday. It's 74 degrees and very cloudy here in upstate New York, quite humid. Apparently, we had a big thunderstorm last night that I completely missed, which means that I was out cold. It was a long, long, long weekend. And by the end, I completely passed out. So where do we begin Monday this week? Last week, we ended with a show titled Petri Dishes, Kill Switches, and Self-Replicating Nano. If you remember, we talked about these self-replicating DNA nano-synthetic particles that they were working on, which is the thing that nightmares are made out of. Definitely, definitely something to keep an eye on. I don't know really where we're going to go today, but I did want to do a couple updates. We have been looking at anthrax and the entire massive anthrax quote-unquote debacle that's been going on, where they've been shipping it all across the world for who the hell knows how long, and then we discover that Hold on one second here. And then we discover that the process for killing the anthrax to begin with was faulty. We also want to take a look at MERS. There was an update over the weekend of the MERS epidemic that's happening in South Korea right now. And get those out of the way, and then I have a couple other things we're going to take a look at. So I did not see any news this weekend in regards to updates on this anthrax. I think when we left things on Friday, it was 51 labs that the Dugway Proving Grounds had shipped anthrax to, maybe 18 states, I believe, three different countries. And there were a few reports and a press conference at the end of last week that basically said that the process that they had been using all this time with x-rays or gamma rays to kill the anthrax apparently had not been sufficient to kill all the anthrax. And they really didn't know how many locations had been affected, how long this has been going on. But the thing that really got me was the fact that a year ago, we had had something very similar happen at the CDC, where they had been shipping these samples out via baggie to different locations and then discovered that it had not been fully killed. And I guess here's my question. As we're watching the terror mantra ramp up across the country and all of these federal agencies warning us that we should be afraid, very afraid, because there's terrorists under every bed, here we have these very same agencies who quote unquote said they were keeping us safe, who are just a bunch of cluster F's running around not having any clue apparently what they're doing. So let's read the story. This came out of The Guardian, looks like yesterday. Latest anthrax scare points to dangerous lack of accountability, experts warned. Whoa, you think? This is what I've been saying. It says 1 week after the terrorist attack in New York and 9/11, another attack on the U.S. began, and that was letters containing spores of anthrax, a weaponized bacterial agent, and they were posted to post offices of several newspapers and two Democratic senators. 22 people were infected and 5 died. Anthrax is a bacterium also often found in soil, according to Gerald Lankin, a doctor who co-edited a book on toxicoterrorism. Its spores are 1 to 5 microns across, small enough to get into human lungs, and the initial symptoms of infection look like flu, but quickly progress to sepsis, hemorrhagic meningitis, and death. Once it progresses to those last stages, the fatality rate is around 95%. And we also discovered, according to the CDC, that you typically don't show symptoms until it is too late. Over the last few weeks, it was revealed that anthrax was sent to. Da, 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 the number's gone up. 52 laboratories in 18 states, plus South Korea, Canada, and Australia. 31 people received treatment for possible exposure. And in 2014, a similar incident saw 75 people possibly exposed to the pathogen, and that was the CDC incident last summer. The difference is this. The first incident was a quote-unquote terrorist attack. The second and the third incidences were accidents, quote-unquote. Samples of the pathogen that were supposed to be inactivated were sent to laboratories by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in 2014 and the Department of Defense most recently. The origin point of this year's accident was Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah, a military facility which produces anthrax in industrial quantities for the purpose of military research, detection mainly, and as a countermeasure. The post 9/11 era saw a huge expansion in the security state. The bioweapon industry was no different. After the 2001 terror attacks with anthrax, known to some as Amerithrax, which I never heard that before, and there was a 20 to 40% increase in the number of institutions and individuals working with biological weapons like anthrax. How great is that? According to Richard Ebright, a molecular biologist and biosecurity expert at Rutgers University, in response to questions from The Guardian, a spokesman for the CDC said that there were 181 organizations or entities such as Dugway registered as working with live anthrax and 321 organizations in total working with live pathogens. Within those 321 entities, according to the Government Accountability Office, there were some 1,495 laboratories accredited under the Federal Select Agent Program to work with live pathogens such as anthrax, and a much larger number working with the inert versions of the same pathogen. Yes, and the scary thought is all of those much larger numbers that have been approved for working with inert pathogens were on that list to receive this anthrax that got shipped out that apparently wasn't killed. Now get this. There is no official government body to oversee production and research of bioweapons that does not, as the CDC does, engage in its own active pathogen research and no apparent fixed official guidelines for regarding their handling. That was something that we talked about briefly on Friday after we listened to a clip. They were saying that all of these different organizations that get shipped this material are not under some sort of standardized process and procedure by some big entity in the sky. They all do their own thing. They all have separate standard operating procedures. And how the hell can you keep control of anything like that? Anyone who's come from the military or military background or a corporate background that's gone under ISO certification knows that you need to have standard operating procedures in a large organization in order to keep order. Okay, you can't just do things willy-nilly and every Joe Schmo who gets their hands on, you know, their own sample can't be doing whatever they want. And especially when we come to bioterror agents, like I just can't even get over how inept these people are. And I mean, this is just one small drop of the bucket with this anthrax. I mean, we see this stuff every day, and it really is highly concerning to me. All right, let's get back to the story. So they've established now that there's nobody anywhere that's in charge of keeping numbers or making sure that everybody sticks to standards as they're shipping this shit all over the place. All right, back to the story. After the CDC's own accident with anthrax back in 2014, and we did hear part of that Senate subcommittee hearing with the head of the CDC saying, whoops, we oopsed, and whoops, we're going to make it better, and we're going to come up with a process. The CDC said that it would hold an official investigation and issue a set of binding guidelines. Well, guess what? No such comprehensive set of guidelines have appeared to have been issued, and it is unclear exactly under what authority the CDC could bind, for example, the Department of Defense. A spokesperson for the CDC told The Guardian that it, quote, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture works jointly on regulating and overseeing the work done on select agents, unquote. However, a 2013 Government Accountability Office report found a, quote, continued lack of national standards for the design, construction, commissioning, and operation of high containment laboratories. So there is not even a standard for building, designing, constructing, commissioning, or operating any high containment laboratories. What? Like, you mean the one that they're building in Kansas to replace Plum Island? Yes, just like that one. And said, quote, that there is no single federal agency that is responsible for assessing overall laboratory needs, unquote. Now, that should make your hair stand completely on end, because we are just setting ourselves up for some sort of bioterror apocalypse, if this is the case. I mean, there is so much, I don't even know what the word is. It's early, people, and it's Monday. Incompetence, I guess would be the word. Across the board, in all of these agencies that we've seen, we have federal agents sitting around on the taxpayer dollar watching porn, and they don't lose their jobs. We have the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, and even Obama's own protection team, the White House Secret Service agents, using taxpayer dollars to buy hookers and booze. And these are going to be the same sorts of federal officials that are in charge with no rules for building high containment facilities and handling on a daily basis bioterror materials. I feel so damn safe. All right, back to the story. According to Ebright, who is this gentleman that they were just quoting, basic rules such as having at least two people in a lab at one time, or even that accredited laboratories should have closed circuit television cameras, do not exist in many such facilities. That's really comforting. They don't even have CCTV. Information regarding the latest breach is relatively scarce. Army Chief of Staff Raymond Ordinaro told reporters, quote, the best I can tell is that there was not human error, unquote. Wow. Really? So not human error, you mean the person who was calibrating that x-ray machine that was supposed to be deactivating this anthrax, and then the people who actually checked to make sure that the anthrax was deactivated, it wasn't their fault. It was the little gnome that's supposed to take care of this. I mean, how can it not be human error? Everything comes back to complete incompetence. Maybe that's a better word for it than error. Because error would mean that at least you had a clue. Incompetence means that you have people who don't have a clue that are getting paid and reaping the benefits, but shouldn't be qualified at all to hold these positions. All right, back to the story. Quote, the fact that this has obviously been happening for some time, and perhaps at several different places, hints at a systemic issue, says Stephen Morse, a professor of epidemiology at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. The Mailman School of Public Health? Is that the school that deals with mailed anthrax? What the hell is the Mailman School of Public Health? Morse, who also has worked at DARPA between 1995 and 2000 on biodefense, speculated that the process by which machines irradiate the live pathogens, which would inactivate them, might be quote unquote poorly calibrated. Okay, so calibration again is something that a human is in charge of, but hey, it is not human error, says the Army Chief of Staff Raymond Ordinaro of Dugway. Luckily for us, says Morris, human beings are relatively resistant to anthrax compared to smallpox. Yes, the smallpox that was found last year also laying around in an unsecured facility on top of a filing cabinet for 30 years. But hey, don't worry about it because nothing happened. Morris says, but that's not something we should rely on. No shit. Indeed, according to Ebright, military contracted laboratories across the U.S. routinely work with other, more dangerous pathogens than anthrax. Well, that should make you feel good. Including, and here we go, several virulent strains of avian flu. Huh. How interesting is that, considering the last number I saw was 14 million culled chickens in, I don't even know how many states it was at this point. It was a large number of states, 18, 22, something like that. And I saw that it is very possible that egg, what's the word when they only let you buy five at a time? Oh my God, it's early. That they've been restricting purchases of eggs in some locations. I think the story I saw was Texas yesterday. Because states like Iowa produce one out of every five, I believe, eggs in the entire country. And as they're culling all these chickens that came down with this never before seen in America, killer strain of avian flu. Put on a seatbelt, people. Who's to say that this didn't come out as some other idiotic lab where there's no controls, no standard operating procedure, and Bozo had a hangover and forgot to put his special gloves on before he sneezed all over it? I don't know, but sounds pretty suspicious to me, and this really is beginning to worry me now. We looked the other day, too, at how the CDC itself took the 1918 flu that caused the massive pandemic that killed millions, and they resuscitated it in a lab, played with it, and then published their results. And that's got to make you feel pretty good. Anyway, back to the story. I want to move on from anthrax. A mistake with one of those. So this is the several virulent strains of avian flu that one of these many unsecured, apparently unsecured labs are dealing with, including anthrax, could have devastating results, says Embright, including a global pandemic. Da, 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 da. That's the end goal, I believe, as all these biotech companies that are in bed with all of our leaders and our senators and congressmen who are welly invested in all their stock options. They're working with all the universities as well and have DARPA sprinkle money to come up with vaccines to protect us from the global pandemics that, of course, have to be coming from those pesky terrorists under every bed. Yes, that global pandemic. It says, nominally, all such labs are working on defenses against these pathogens, but it has become, Embright said, all pork barrel, with at least one lab in every single state. Guys, all we got to do is pull out the stopper all at the same time, once in every state, and bazingo. There we go. Mass pandemic, 50 states, people dying everywhere. Line up for your vaccine so your children don't start bleeding out their eyes. And this, the implications of this are absolutely horrific. He continues, it's spending that can't possibly be defended on any rational basis. Thank you very much, Mr. Ebright. With each of the incidences in the past, there have been notable absences of responsibility. But they know that if you mess up, hey, nothing happens. The programs aren't reduced. The personnel suffer no consequences. So it's all about the worst you could possibly have, he says. Nobody is watching. There are no rules. And there is no accountability. Bang! That's the problem. That is the massive problem right there. But it gets even better than this. And this Ebright must listen to our show because he's basically saying what we've been saying for a while now. According to Ebright, and isn't this the dude who worked at DARPA? No, that was Morse. Okay. According to Ebright, the real issue isn't a question of danger to the public from the accidental sending itself. It is the chance that the pathogen, which happens to be the same strain used in the 2001 attack, could fall into the wrong hands. Yes, remember, ISIS is under every bed and in every closet right now and on that pesky internet. Quote, now, wait, didn't we hear last week in the clips that we listened to, especially in the press conference from the Department of Defense, they said, don't worry about it. The samples were so tiny that they didn't pose any type of threat to anyone. So don't worry. Nobody is at risk here. And I said that multiple times. Well, listen to this. Quote, even one, count them, one finger, index finger in the air, one, even one spore is a sufficient seed stock from which an amount could grow to mount a biological weapons attack, says Ebright. One spore. The sad circumstance is that this massive effort since 2001 has actually dramatically increased the chances, yes, increased the chances of a biological weapon attack on the U.S. precisely by distributing a highly lethal strain of an agent with no structure and no ability to record where they have gone, unquote. Wow. So doesn't that translate into pretty much the U.S. has set itself up for a massive biological attack and what? Yes, given the terrorists the pathogens to do it with. Wow. So much for keeping you safe, because it's come out now that we are set up and ready to rock and roll. I don't know, people, get your masks. I don't really know what we could even do. I mean, a bioterror attack, out of all the different types of attacks, a bioterror attack, to me at least, is probably the scariest of all, because typically you can become Typhoid Mary and not even know it. Regardless of what the pathogen is, they typically take some sort of incubation time, some a lot longer than others. Obviously, the longer the incubation period, and depending on how long you're infectious without showing signs and symptoms, will then dictate how far it spreads. But even if it was just a day or two where you were not showing symptoms, but you were contagious, you could do a lot of damage just as one person if you look at the average individual and how far they travel. And especially with, you know, airlines and whatever, you know, back in 1918, we weren't jet setting all over the globe. And we listened to that interview with Bill Gates when he talked about the pandemic of 1918 and just how amazing it was when they started running the records through their algorithm to form this map. How amazing it was that within like a week, I believe he said, or maybe it was even less than that, it had gotten into every major city on the globe. So now add to that the ability to travel quickly from coast to coast, from country to country, and all you need is one or two Typhoid Marys. And we got labs in all 50 states that apparently have no rhyme or reason in the way they hold or handle these materials. This is just very, very, very frightening to me. And apparently they have no structure and no record as to where any of these samples have gone. All right, let's finish the last three paragraphs here. So anyway, it says, nor is this the only slip-up that has been made at Dugway. In 2011, the base was placed on lockdown. I remember this. For several hours after a vial containing a deadly nerve agent went missing, the BBC reported at the time. We actually covered that story. It was right when I first started doing radio. The major concern is that in a security breach, the material will be transferred to, yes, domestic terror and international terror and be used as the seed source for a bomb or bioweapon, says Ebright. It would be, and this is the understatement of the year, disappointing if the Department of Defense actually becomes the supplier for Al-Qaeda that enables a bioweapon attack. Wow, do you think? And I mean, here's the question, and I've asked this so many times, is this accidental or is this intentional? You cannot have this much incompetence, or can you really? In an agency dealing with such virulent pathogens, we find out that it's all across the board. It's like the bumbling gaggle of idiots that were supposedly in charge of Fukushima that now I see all more horrible, awful things. And by the way, speaking of Fukushima, I was wondering, I was gone this weekend, but when I came home, I've had a rad meter going since 2011, feeding my readings out to radiationnetwork.com for upstate New York. And the readings haven't been that bad. I mean, you could see during storms and stuff, and especially when the jet stream is directly over us, you could see the numbers go up a bit. But I think that even from the very first days after the accident, the highest count that I've ever seen here would be between 32 and 35 counts per minute. But my average is typically under 10 counts per minute. Well, since I've been back this weekend, I'm up to an average of 12 counts per minute. But I have been holding a sustain now for about the last day between 20 and 28 counts per minute. And it actually gives me a graphical chart. You could see the graph has gone way up. And I was wondering if something had happened in the last 48 hours or so. And if you give me just a second, let me get over to Fukushima Facts, because as I was scrolling through the news this morning, I caught something that had, and if I can find it quick, I caught something that had hit that page auto. Here it is. Let me see if I can click on it. This is out of Any News, titled "Government Expert: West Coast will be hit by 800 trillion becquerels of Fukushima cesium-137, nearly equal to the amount of fallout deposited on Japan. Levels in the Pacific way higher than expected. Main body of surface plume has reached off the coast of the U.S., and it never slowed down while crossing the ocean, contrary to predictions." I mean, anyone who thinks that it never hit California, I can tell you that within the first few weeks of the accident, they already were detecting it in Europe. France and a couple other countries had real-time monitors that were online and had not, as far as I know, at least in the beginning, been jacked downwards to hide the seriousness of the problem in the beginning days. France was the only country that was warning about staying away from rainwater, strawberries, any type of greens that were growing, especially in California, and things that couldn't be peeled, milk, all for children and pregnant women especially. So if it made it to Europe, guess what, people? It already came over the top of us. So anyone who's out there, and I still hear people saying that Fukushima isn't that bad, and oh my God, it's a bunch of fearmongers. Remember, radiation is one of those things that they could have lots of plausible deniability for. You know, unless you get hit by a mega dose neutron zap, or someone turns an X-ray machine on you for 10 hours at a time, you're probably not going to drop dead immediately. But I can guarantee you it's probably going to do some damage to your DNA. The only things I can really offer you, I would say, look up curcumin, the active ingredient in turmeric. Read up about whether or not that's right for you. I know there are some cautions because it does thin the blood. So if you're on any type of blood thinner, you're probably going to want to be really careful. But I would say look into something like turmeric that causes apoptosis in cancer cells, and in some of the vitamins and minerals that we typically are lacking that radioactive isotopes mimic, such as like iodine in the uptake in our thyroid. That would be if there's still radioactive iodine 131 floating around, which I don't even know. But if there are still live reactions going on, there would be. Of course, there's no information really now about what's coming out of there or what's going on, except that the IAEA, I heard, according to Libby's newest show, has instructed TEPCO to, you know what, stop storing the water in all those leaky vats, just start dumping it into the ocean outright, which should make all of us just about be ready for tears, because that is no kind of legacy we want to be leaving for our children. All right. So what are we going to look at next? South Korea. We talked about them last week. They now have a pretty large outbreak of MERS, which typically was only seen in the Middle East. First and never before seen before 2012. It appeared in Saudi Arabia, and oh yes, they're not sure where it came from, but they think it might be camels. Yes, those pesky camels, just like the pesky fruit bats. Now, my machine I typically work on, of course, as soon as the show started, everything went to syrup, but the backup machine, I believe, is connecting. So it looks like South Korea now has 14 more MERS cases. I saw Friday it was like over 1,600, I believe, that they had in quarantine already. There have now been 5 deaths over 4. Let's do just an update on this.
On the streets of Seoul, face masks have become the norm. Residents and tourists are taking more precautions after health officials announced a 5th death from the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, commonly known as MERS.
And was that it? No. There's girls talking, but there's no voice for the girls. But they're from South Korea, so they're probably...
The country's outbreak is the largest outside the Middle East, stirring fears over the government's response. Health Ministry Public Health Policy Director Kwon Jun-wook says there are now 64 cases. He says the outbreak is likely to continue.
There are a number of patients who have been confirmed as MERS cases yesterday and today, and I assume there will be more cases tomorrow.
MERS is caused by a coronavirus of the same family that triggers severe acute respiratory syndrome, but has a much higher death rate.
And severe acute respiratory syndrome, if anyone remembers, that was SARS. SARS was very prevalent in China for quite a while there. That was a few years back. Again, you know, these viruses that just appear from anywhere. It was a coronavirus. And one of the things that they had been messing with back in 2011, if I recall correctly, they were messing around with the common cold. And there had been 3 studies published in different scientific journals, if you could call them that. One was National Geographic, Discover Magazine, and I don't remember if it was like Scientific American or what was it, other publication I used to read. There were a couple of them, but there were 3 different studies that were published at the time looking at, if you remember that big push about the zombie virus and zombies were everywhere. We had zombie TV shows and zombie emergency preparedness drills going on. And it was all about the zombie. Well, one of the things that had come out, I believe it was in National Geographic, and we found it, and I still never got back to reading that story. I'll have to find it again, was how to actually make a zombie virus. And in probably one of the most plausible, they had actually used, they had said, well, one of the things that you would have to make sure you did was use some sort of base pathogen that was easily transmissible from person to person, because that's how you get a pandemic to start, right? Person to person transmission. And they had said, well, hey, like the cold virus, air droplets, you know, they can sneeze, that'll live on a doorknob. That would be a good one. So let's start with the cold virus. And then let's see what would work on getting rid of higher levels of brain function and give you bloodlust. They were like, oh, hey, what about rabies? And that was kind of the idea they came out with. And they published those results about mixing cold virus with rabies. And they said it would be quite an effective zombie virus. I mean, so when we see other pathogens that come out like this, and especially never before seen, it was only seen first time ever, according to Sanjay Gupta on Friday. in the Middle East. It seems very suspicious to me, especially when we know about genomics and how they're trying to crack every key of the secrets of life, whether or not they could actually be building synthetic or lab-built viruses that would be targeting certain populations. All right, here's something else I want to look at. I've mentioned this a whole bunch of times when we've talked about food, pathogens, infection, the FDA, the USDA, all being in bed with other agencies and corporations, another group, gaggle of incompetents that are supposed to be keeping us safe, but we know that there are all kinds of fraudulent studies that the FDA never made any of the biotech, biopharma companies retract or redact when there's found to be fraudulence in the studies or completely incorrect studies that were published. Well, one of the things that I brought up was a story that I had listened to about the cancerous meat that had gotten onto the market and how they were getting that onto the market. They were swapping out healthy heads of cows, trimming off the cancer, and getting it approved and onto market. We had also talked about this huge nationwide, if not global, actually, incidence of quote-unquote Alzheimer's disease and how Alzheimer's, mad cow, BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, chronic wasting disease, scrapie, they're all very, very similar type pathogens that cause your brain to pretty much go to Swiss cheese. You get these plaques in there and you start to lose your nervous system and your memory. It's a pretty horrible, horrible way to die. And at the time when mad cow disease first reared its ugly head on the market and we became aware of it, remember, George Bush and crew were in charge and all their friends happened to be cattle ranchers. I saw a story the other day that they're saying that out of all the cows ever, all of them ever, there have only ever been 4 cases ever identified. I call absolute huge piles of elephant shit on that one. I can't imagine that the way they were rendering all of these neurological scraps of their dead brethren and rendering it into the feed that then they were refeeding these cows. That was how they blamed bovine for getting this disease, because they were feeding them the diseased nerve tissue from their friends and family that were slaughtered before them. So they took that out of the feed now. Now that supposedly isn't in our food or in the cow's food. But out of all the cows and all the time that they were feeding them rendered nerve material, only 4 cows, apparently, ever got sick, and there was no threat to public health ever. But don't worry about it, because good old Georgie Porgy and all of his friends had money in cattle ranching. Well, I found that story that I've been talking about with the cancerous meat that shows just how easy it is to get around not only the FDA, but the USDA. So put on a seatbelt. I believe this was from May of 2014.
CNN has learned what investigators believe happened inside the Rancho Feeding Corporation, the plant behind one of the biggest meat recalls in years. It involves cancerous cows, meat not fit for human consumption, and an illicit romance. Federal officials familiar with the investigation believe Rancho processed cancerous cows when government inspectors were not there, and after they were slaughtered, hid the warning signs of cancer, trimming off diseased parts, using a fake stamp of approval, or even replacing the heads of sick cows with healthy ones.
Ding, ding, ding. And a fake stamp of approval, people. Fake stamps of approval. And nobody caught that? When the investigators left, they just started killing cancerous cows? Who's to say that they weren't killing cows that were having trouble walking with signs of bovine spongiform encephalopathy. Say that 5 times fast. more affectionately known as Mad Cow.
It's not clear which employees were involved.
But that's not all. CNN has learned that the government's own food safety inspector, the person responsible for protecting consumers from bad meat, was having a romantic relationship with a plant foreman.
Oh, so not only that, we had a honeypot going on to boot. How many times do you think that's happening across the United States?
CNN obtained an email sent to the USDA that details the romance between USDA Inspector Lynette Thompson and a plant foreman. The email says the foreman admitted to an assistant plant manager he had, quote, been seeing Lynette Thompson and went to her trailer three different times, and they were intimate. The email included personal texts said to be between Thompson and the man. She texts, I need a kiss later. He responds, me too. And this one where Thompson says, play dumb, please, for my kids. Delete everything, okay? Documents show there was an acrimonious relationship between Thompson and plant officials, and she had complained about the processing of cancerous cows. But having a romance with a plant employee is against USDA rules for an inspector. We tried to get in touch with Lynette Thompson, but were told she did not want to speak to CNN. Rancho has since been sold, and the former owners won't talk on camera. But the lawyer for one of them did, and Jeffrey Bornstein says the relationship between the foreman and the inspector was not connected to the recall. But he did admit his client, Jesse Amaral, made mistakes.
There were opportunities for cows to have gone through the process without proper inspection or otherwise properly being handled.
Now, this is just one farm. How many times a day do you think this is repeated across the United States? And I see someone in chat saying, what happened to Mad Cow? And then it's gone. Well, you know, what I want to look at next are the facts and figures for Alzheimer's. I want to know why all of a sudden we have this explosion of Alzheimer's. Are they really doing autopsies on these people after the fact? The question is it really Alzheimer's? Why do we have these brain-wasting diseases that are now affecting the baby boomers at epidemic rates? Oh, what? It was the aluminum? Well, I don't know. Was it the aluminum or was it something else? We probably will never know, but I'm just raising the question. We seem to think that because we go to the grocery store and it's wrapped in plastic with a price tag that it's safe to eat, and I'm saying that it probably isn't safe to eat at all. And yes, we knew that, but how badly did we know that? That they're putting healthy heads with cancerous cows when an inspector shows up once a month?
Bornstein says his client is sorry, but the owner had no intent to hurt the public.
Of course not. We were just putting all this food that wasn't fit for human consumption out onto the streets, but I didn't intend to hurt the public. I just wanted to do it for my kids, he said. I needed the dangling carrot dollar to make me feel better, and I can sleep at night. Don't worry about it when I have all my cars and my three houses.
He takes responsibility for mistakes in judgment that were made. He made mistakes in judgment. He regrets not being better able to recognize, respond, and to stop some of these alleged bad practices.
Oh, he regrets not being able to stop. How about cameras? How about, again, having some sort of standard operating procedure where people are watching and logging what you're doing? I mean, you can't trust anybody. People, I've come to that conclusion, the human race is pretty much absolutely failed in morals. There are no morals. There are no ethics. It is anything goes. If I can make some extra money or dip my wick, I'm going to do it for that dangling carrot and fuck everybody else. I mean, what kind of a society is this?
Bornstein says his client is cooperating with the federal investigation, but wouldn't discuss specifics of what went on in the plant. Neither will the federal officials who are conducting the criminal investigation.
Yes, neither would the federal officials who are conducting the investigation.
That has Congressman Jared Huffman wondering if the USDA has something to hide.
One would speculate at this point that in order for there have been a deception that allowed a whole bunch of improperly processed meat to get certified for sale, someone at USDA was deceived, right? Something must have broken down in their process too.
So in the USDA as well, FDA and USDA both fail. Bing.
And so I'm in the absence of information, I'm left to believe that maybe they're a little concerned that they dropped the ball too.
How come all these federal agencies do nothing but drop the ball? That's what I'd like to know. Yet nobody gets fired. Nobody is held accountable. And we are the ones who suffer. But hey, don't worry about it. Because every time you get a new disease, they got an injection for that, right? All right, so check this out. I am on the Alzheimer's ALZ.org page under facts. Every 67 seconds, someone in the United States develops Alzheimer's. Yes, every 67 seconds. This is very much reminding me of the fact that, what are they predicting, by 2030, 50% of all children will also be autistic. It says an estimated 5.3 million Americans of all ages now have Alzheimer's disease in 2015. Of the 5.3 million Americans with Alzheimer's, an estimated 5.1 million are ages 65 and older, and approximately 200,000 individuals are under age 65. Almost two-thirds of Americans with Alzheimer's are women. Of the 5.1 million people age 65 or older with Alzheimer's in the United States, 3.2 million are women, 1.9 million are men. And although there are more non-Hispanic whites living with Alzheimer's and other dementia than other people in any other ethnic group in the United States, older African Americans and Hispanics are more likely than older whites to have Alzheimer's and other dementias. The number of Americans with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias will grow each year as the size and proportion of the U.S. population age 65 and older continues to increase. And guess what? By 2025, the number of people age 65 and older with Alzheimer's is estimated to be upwards of 7.1 million. So guys, that's you and me and just about everyone in our age group will be diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I mean, how frightening is this? Who the hell knows what's causing it? But there obviously are many things that it could potentially be, whether it's aluminum in our pans, pots and pans that we used in the 70s, or in the injections they gave us, or in the cancerous cows, or hey, the four cases of mad cow that we apparently maybe consumed over the last 25 years. How about what's being pumped into our atmosphere pollution-wise, or in our GMO food, or in this mad experiment gone mad with the Earth as a Petri dish? There's definitely something going on here. By 2050, the number of people age 65 and older with Alzheimer's may nearly triple to a projected from 5.1 million now to a projected 13.8 million people, barring the development of medical breakthroughs to prevent or cure the disease. Now, we did see something a few weeks back in Australia where they were using ultrasound on the brain that seemed to destroy amyloid plaques. But one of the other things that we had read about using ultrasound to destroy amyloid plaques is that it also allowed them to circumvent the blood-brain barrier, which I would say caution to that. Because all of this nanotech that they're trying to get into us and put into our food, RNAi that's in some of these newfangled vaccinations, virus-like particles. Remember, some of that stuff is not small enough to pass the blood-brain barrier, but if they open that up, it's all fair game. Somebody else actually mentioned a story that I saw yesterday as well, and it is out of RT. It says, bees with Alzheimer's? They are linking aluminum pollution to dementia in bees. Now, if we go back to some of the stuff we also read or heard by Dr. Huber, and if you haven't looked at any Dr. Huber stuff, you have to search Dr. Huber. You'll find it. GMO. Dr. Huber has actually linked glyphosate to some of what is happening with the bees, but it's not the glyphosate directly. It's the fact that glyphosate chelates out essential nutrients and minerals from the organism that are exposed to it. And that chelation of necessity of necessary minerals and nutrients is what is potentially causing the dementia in bees. And I believe that he was talking about manganese at the time. There is a large lack of manganese that they're finding in the bees exposed to glyphosate. We can read a little bit of this, though, because who the hell knows what it is again? I mean, it could be anything, but just know there are so many poisons. It really is the extermination of biological life as we know it through greed and dangling carrots where no one gave a fuck. And everyone did it because they wanted to, quote unquote, feed their kids with no worries about what you're doing to my kids or the bees or the planet or any of the ecosystem. It's just horrifying. Says the decline in bee population could be caused by the insect's high contamination of aluminum, a chemical element implicated as a factor in Alzheimer's disease in humans, a new study has found. Now, wait, there's more. When we had Francis Mangles, who Francis worked for the Forestry Service and a lot of other government environmental agencies over the years. He was somebody that Zori knew. He actually was in Why in the World and What in the World Are We Spraying? We had Francis on as a guest a few times. Francis has been taking soil samples for like 30, 40, 50 years, very, very long time up in the Pacific Northwest. And one of the things that he's been finding has been increasing in the soils over the years happens to be aluminum. Now, where's the aluminum coming from? I don't know. Is it coming from geoengineering? Is it coming from industrial pollution? I don't think we will ever know. Plausible deniability makes that beautifully perfect that we can't point a finger at anybody. But there apparently is a larger amount of aluminum in the environment. It is believed that a number of factors are likely to be involved in the decline of bees, from a lack of flowers to an attack by parasites. Again, I think that some of those have been refuted by Dr. Huber. But biologists at Keele University and the University of Sussex in the UK decided to find out whether aluminum, the, quote, most significant environmental contaminant of recent times, unquote, could prove to play a key role in the insect's decline. Previous research had suggested that when bees forage for nectar, they don't avoid nectar, which contains aluminum. So researchers measured the content of aluminum in bee pupae taken from naturally foraging colonies in the UK, and they found that the metal content in bee pupae had ranged from 13 to 193 parts per million. In humans, brain aluminum content in excess of 3 parts per million might be considered as pathological, with possible contributions toward neurodegenerative diseases, including Alzheimer's, the study published in the Journal of PLOS-1 had said. Researchers say that a number of human activities, such as burning of fossil fuels resulting in acid rain and the mining of aluminum ores, makes aluminum metal and salts, and they have contributed to the thriving biological availability of this quote-unquote non-essential metal. And as a result, fish, trees, crops, and humans have been affected by aluminum. Evidence suggests that bees are not immune to this increasing prevalence, with analysis from Brazil having previously indicating that pollen is heavily contaminated with aluminum. So in places like New York State, who had a pollen apocalypse this year because we had such a horrifyingly cold winter that all the trees went completely apeshit when they bloomed this year. It's wonderful because we're probably all inhaling that stuff as well. All right, very last thing here in the last few minutes. We had talked about this a few weeks back, and there was a new story that came out of Australia in Science Alert. And if anyone ever had a case for eugenics, this might be it. All right, so there's a new study, guys. Here we go. Poor lifestyle choices can be passed on to future generations through your DNA. Here's the subtitle. Well, that's unfortunate. Yeah, sure it is. As they finish getting us all bagged and tagged and into the database and running their algorithms so they can see very easily in a spreadsheet those of us who have made poor lifestyle choices, who are going to have quote-unquote bad DNA to pass on to future generations, that'll give you the red dot. Yes, the red dot. To be disabled. To maybe not ever reproduce. Because our DNA is faulty. Says new research has shown, yes, for the very first time, that traces of our poor lifestyles, environmental stressors, and trauma can be passed down to future generations through our DNA, potentially making our children more prone to conditions such as, yes, mental illness and obesity. Scientists already knew that significant traumatic events such as famine could leave their mark on future generations. And yes, that was the epigenetics that we read about. But this is the first time that they have been able to observe the mechanism by which this happens. They have found that, contrary to previously assumed, our genetic slate does not get completely wiped clean for our offspring. Our DNA is constantly being altered by our environment, what is known as our epigenome. Basically, epigenetic changes are the changes that affect which genes in our DNA are switched off and on throughout our lives. Yeah, and that's before they introduced RNAi that could do that as well, which means that they have a pretty profound effect on our health. But before this, scientists thought that all of these epigenetic changes, which are influenced by things such as our diets and stress levels, couldn't be passed down through our sperms and eggs. And each generation started with a clean slate. Look out, people. They're going to be watching your supermarket super savvy tag to see who's buying Cheesy Puffs, because that's going to make you a bad breeder of the future. The information needs to be reset in every generation before further information is added to regulate development of a newly fertilized egg. It's like erasing a computer disk before you add new data. The team has now been able to describe this epigenetic erasing process in humans, which occurs between 2 and 9 weeks of an embryo's development, and for the first time have shown that not all of these environmental changes get wiped clean. In fact, around 5% of our DNA is resistant. All right, guys, make sure you stick around. It's Monday night. We have a brand new Truth on the Tracks.